I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. We're back with another episode of The Stacks, and I am your host, Tracy Thomas. Our guest today is the wonderful actor, director, and writer, Wade Elaine Marcus, and he and I are going to do a deep dive into Friday Black by Nana Kwame Adegbenye for The Stacks Book Club. Nana was our guest on The Short Stacks this week, so go hear him talk about how this book came to be and learn a little bit more about the stories. There also will be spoilers on today's episode, so I suggest that you read the book first and then come back and listen, or just go ahead and listen to the Short Stacks episode with Nana. Okay, if you're listening and enjoying The Stacks, I want you to know you have my patrons, aka the Stacks Pack, to thank for that. Patreon is a membership website that allows you to help support this show while enjoying perks for yourself. We do the virtual book club where we get on a video chat to discuss the most recent Stacks Book Club books, and that's all something that we do with our patrons. So if you're interested in being a part of this amazing, generous group of humans, all it takes is as little as $1 a month and you can be in the Stacks Pack. So if you're interested, go to patreon.com/thestacks, give what you can. If a monthly contribution isn't your thing, consider one-time contributions. You can go to paypal.me/thestackspod and give what you can, and that also helps a ton. To stay up to date on The Stacks, make sure that you're following us on social media and going to the website www.thestackspodcast.com. Links to all of our social media accounts are in the show notes. You'll also find links to everything we talk about on today's show. If you shop through those links, The Stacks will earn a small commission, and it comes at no extra cost to you. So it's kind of a win-win. Now is a great time to rate and review this podcast. These reviews help us climb the charts, break through the algorithms, and get to new listeners. So if you haven't yet, I would appreciate you do so now. Our most recent review comes from Sad Emoji Nada, and they say, "This is the best bookish podcast. Great conversation and fantastic books. I always look forward to listening. Thank you for creating this magic." First of all, please only refer to The Stacks as magic from now on, because that just made my day. Second of all, thank you so much for writing your review. These reviews are so important to the show, and I would love it if you would just take a moment to write one. Okay, now it's time for The Stacks Book Club conversation. We're talking about Nana Kwame Adegbenye's short story collection, Friday Black, with our lovely guest, Wade Elaine Marcus, and his sometimes chatty dog, Tika. All right, we are back again this week with actor, director, screenwriter Wade Elaine Marcus. And for the Stacks Book Club today, we're talking about Friday Black by Nana Kwame Adegbenye, which is a short story collection. it kind of defies genre. So I think we're just going to talk about it. I'm not even going to really tell you what it's about, but I will say this, we will spoil everything in this book. So if you haven't read it yet and you want to, and you care, stop listening, come back later. But Wade, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tracy.
So excited you're here. We're going to just dive in. What did you think of Friday Black?
Absolutely loved it. I mean, it also kind of brings me back to when we were talking about Marquez and this like magical realism, except that he has done it in a way that is contemporary for me, you know,
right.
As far as like, okay, so this is a young man who is a direct product of what we have been into. He's clearly responding to the moment over the last 5 or 6 years, let's say, which has kind of put us in a very new place with Trump, with school shootings, with Ferguson and Baltimore, and like everything that has happened that has really kind of created this new civil rights. And so using these kind of absurd, violent, and magical realism qualities, he has really, really painted an extraordinary picture and a terrifying picture of where we are right now.
Right. I agree. I really like the book, but I'm going to be honest and just say that I think I missed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I understood a lot. I was talking to a friend of mine that I've met through this podcast, Reggie, and he was saying that, you know, there's a reference, like he thinks there's a reference to Song of Solomon. He thinks there's a reference to Parable of the Sower and like all this stuff that I was like, oh, that's not something that I know. So I feel like I missed some referential stuff in the text, but I also think I missed the point sometimes or wasn't quite sure what he was saying.
Yeah.
Which I don't mind as a reader. Like I come to reading knowing that I don't know a lot, so it's okay. But sometimes I was confused like how some of the stories fit together. But the ones that like really resonated with me, like after I read the first story, Finkelstein 5, I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest story collection ever. Like,
because
that one was just so powerful. Mm-hmm. And then there were some where I finished and I was like, huh?
Yeah, no, completely agree. And some where it was like, you know, I'm reading the entire story and I don't know what's going on. And then the last moment, there's just this feeling, there's this rush that I'll
right.
get. And I may not have completely comprehended what
right.
I just read, but that feeling I got pretty much for, I would say, 90% of the stories.
Yeah, it's actually what you were saying last week about like the work that you like to create or like the things you like to consume and new people, that it's not always the literal understanding, but the feeling that you get.
Exactly.
Because that's true. Like I could feel sometimes what he was trying to say or do, and the words didn't match what my understanding was necessarily.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, because it's oddly like, you know, he's creating something very visual here, right? Everything that he's painting, whether it is the violence, whether it is the kind of like floating human beings or shoe looking human beings, is a very clear and vivid picture of what he wants us to see. And that what we're seeing is what, you know, what I gather is what he's feeling from whatever it is, the story that he's telling.
Right. And normally we talk about the cover at the end, but maybe we should kind of talk about it right now. The thing about this book, as soon as I saw like a picture of the cover, I was like, oh, I kind of know what this is. Like I kind of knew, even though I didn't even notice that what the cover was, like just the colors and the lines and the font and all of that. I was like, oh, this is going to be something really like big and cinematic. Like it just, the vibe of the cover is like, has like some gravitas in a way that feels kind of magical and weird and different.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
It's funny actually, because I think New People has like a similar kind of cover. I mean, it's like, it's a lot more, it's simpler. I
feel like the New People cover is like a little like kind of like quirky and like might be fun. And this cover to me is like,
darker.
Yo, like here I come.
Yeah.
Like here
that's
I
funny.
Am.
I don't feel like New People is like fun, the cover. Like the purple.
It's like,
the
it's
black.
Like purple and I don't know. Yeah. Not, it has a little darkness to it, but this to me.
But there's an abstractness, I guess, to both.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I'm drawing you in to a world that may not be the world that we know exactly as it is.
Right. And like when you look at the cover, you don't necessarily see anything right away. And then it's like, as I was reading and then I got to that story,
because
it's the line, what is it? The spider.
Yeah. The line and the
Is that what it's called?
Whisper?
The Line and the Spider or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's that story. And I was like, oh. And then I was like, oh, I wonder why he picked that.
Totally. Because that's the one that I really didn't get.
Really?
You liked that one?
I didn't. There were a few. Yes. I liked it. I don't know. No, you're right. I probably didn't love that one. But
it is the one that's really like, it's completely different from the rest of them.
Right. And I the dad in that, yes. I kind of like liked him. I kind of could like relate to that like black dadness that he had.
Yeah, for
you
sure.
You know? But yeah, like, I mean, I also do, I think Friday Black is a great title, but I don't know that to me that story was necessarily the one that I would have picked for the title.
Right.
But I also don't know how you pick a title for a short story collection because I always feel that way. I'm always like, oh, why'd you pick this one?
Right. Is it? Yeah, I wouldn't know that either. Is it always a story from the collection? No. Sometimes usually, you have like another story.
I don't read a ton of short stories, to be fair, but of the ones I've read, it's almost always one of the stories. Same with essays. It's almost always one of the title of the essays. If it were me, I probably would have called, well, Friday Black is really gripping and cool. Yeah. And you're like, what does this mean?
Totally.
But I think like, as far as encompassing what the stories are, I think that The Era also could have had a good shot.
Yeah, for sure. The Era 100% would be the thing that is more like what this story is.
Right.
But Friday Black, like, I think the kind of point of the stories is like, I'm just going to get you.
Right.
You know, I'm going to get you in this way that like, is going to shock you and kind of keep you.
He's like a provocateur. He wants us 100%. To think and be like, what is this that we're consuming, right? Like, what is this book? What does it mean? He strikes me as someone who is very conscious of audience understanding. Like, you know, some people are like, I just write for myself. And it seems to me that he's one of those people who writes for his audience and like has an intention of like, this is meant to be shared.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily that he's worried about what people will think of it, but that he's writing with other people in mind.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But I think the people really are, you know, the people of the generation that are like living it right now.
Totally. You know? Like he could be writing in his mind for his best friend. I don't know. But it feels like he knows
who's reading
that someone's coming to read this.
Yeah. No, 100%. Well, because it's this odd, like almost like mixed media thing. Mm-hmm. Like the point, the reason it's so visual for me is so that it grips you that much. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, we see so many things. We consume so much now on our phones. Like if we're scrolling through Instagram or whatever, like we're looking at images constantly. And I feel like he's so cognizant of that he is creating those pictures that will.
But he doesn't really talk about social media a ton here, which I thought was interesting because he does feel so much of like this certain generation. Like, I guess, I don't know. I think he's about 27, 28, which would make him kind of the end of the millennial.
Right. Well, no, that's what was so interesting. It feels like this is like what someone who's maybe watched. Oh, wow. Just as we were talking about Black Mirror, Siri
chimes
gets involved. but that's what I was just going to say. Like someone who's watched something like Black Mirror or seen these other dystopian things that are like, ooh, what can happen from your phone? And he's like, yeah, like, I don't know. That's old shit to me.
Right.
And I really want to talk more about really political things.
Right. And like what happens to humans as a result of it, not so much of what the... Not he's not so much worried about what technology will or won't do. He's worried about how humans respond to it.
Yeah. Well, we now have some research and results of what technology can do, you know, like Trump or even like Obama. You know what I mean? Both of those presidents came to us through social media to a certain degree, right? But just very different versions of it. We got very different aspects.
Right.
And so now he's like, okay, so what do I do with that information?
Right,
to that next place. I mean...
I've heard him talk in a few interviews. He was on Seth Meyers' show, which I thought was pretty cool.
Oh, that is cool.
But he also was on the New York Times podcast. And they asked him something about like, do you ever think you would write not political stuff or something, which I think is a dumb question because I think that implies like so much inherent whiteness, like to be able to quote unquote write something not political is like such a privilege.
Yeah.
But he responded being like, even if I wrote about rainbows, like there would be something political about that because that's my point of view. And so I really, it excites me to know that that's like, if he's the start of this next turn of writers, like that's what we have to look forward to, this like connection to being political and not something that's a byproduct, but that it's an intentional thing. Because this book feels very intentionally political, violent. He's saying, he's got like a huge commentary on what's going on. And the other thing that I freaking love, and I think maybe he mentioned this, is that all the characters, or not all, but most, I believe, of the characters in this book are Black. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't always say it.
Right.
He doesn't always say, like, his chocolate skin. Like, sometimes you're like, maybe.
Yeah, no, that's what is so fascinating. Because I feel like, for us, like, our work was always, like, race is going to be involved. Mm-hmm. There's no way that I can create something that mm-hmm. doesn't have to do with race.
Right.
But then when I talk to my brother, who's 10 years younger than me, he still feels that to a certain degree, but it is more of a political thing.
Right.
It's more like, no, what is my race in the world, as right. opposed to just like, what does it mean to be Black in America or mixed in America? It's kind of like that next thing. So there's no need to say what we are, because I'm not like doing an investigation on what it means to be Black in America. It's there's some other things going on.
Right. But I also, I mean, I think some of it though is also like Brenya said, basically is saying, I am not going to tell you that this person is Black. And then when you find out later in the story, you're going to feel dumb because you assumed it was a white person. And like, I got you. And that's part of like that he's playing with that too, that like assumption, that default to whiteness.
Totally.
Right. Like in the first story, I mean, we have that Blackness scale.
I was just going to say that.
Let's talk about the first story. It was my, I mean, it was my favorite, I think by far. I mean, maybe not by far, but it was definitely a standout as my favorite. And so that's the Finkelstein Five. So it follows a guy named Emmanuel, and he is a Black man. And within the first like two pages, we find out that there's this Blackness scale that he's judging his Blackness on. So he picks up a phone call and his Blackness is like down to a two.
Right.
And so
he can control it.
Yeah, he can control it. And since he's on the phone, he can talk in his like white voice. Mm-hmm. Which we all have, we being people of color.
Yes.
And then he says, like, but when you see me, I can only get as low as a four or mm-hmm. something. So it's like,
well, that's what I thought was so fascinating, was starting with that story.
Yeah.
Because he was essentially doing that through these stories.
Right.
Like, as he told these stories, he's like, I'm going to have my Blackness at 10, or I'm going to have my Blackness at four.
Right.
The way that I'm telling this story to you.
Right.
Because he goes through different scenarios that feel more Black or not.
Right, right. So like this story has a lot going on, but that's like the first part of it, but it's all in relationship to this recent verdict that's come out. A white guy killed five Black kids outside of a library by chainsaw to quote unquote protect his own children. And so the trial, he's acquitted within 28 minutes of the jury going to deliberate. And you like the book or the story kind of flashes back to the trial and what's going on. And then in the present moment, there's this response called naming, mm-hmm. which is so fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
It's young Black people are getting dressed up in their like best suits, ties, like this full respectability politics, pants pulled up, belts, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, going into public places, yelling over and over the name of one of the children, carving the number five into their own skin, and then inflicting acts of violence against white people.
Yep.
Which is just like, to actually imagine that, like being on a bus and experiencing that is wild, but also to imagine coming to a place as a group of people, as like as the Black community, where that's the only way you can respond.
Yeah.
Is wild.
And it's so interesting to think about, like, you know, domestic terrorism is mostly white people, right?
Right.
And so in some ways, he's kind of using like what white people do in our country.
Right.
Being like, how do you think that would look if it was us doing that?
Right.
And it's this like odd thing where you're like, this is the only way. Because I think he's not really like taking sides on so many things, like even in Friday Black and consumerism. I mean, obviously he has these consumers being zombies, mm-hmm. but there is this certain degree of like, this needs to be happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just love the way that he's able to kind of like lay out what these stories are in ways that are like, this is what you're fucking doing.
Right. And there's satire in it.
Oh my God.
Like there's the part in Finkelstein Five where he's talking about whatever the lawyer was saying. And it was like, sure, we have laws, but who do you love more, your children or your law? It's like, that's actually not like an actual equivalency, but that's so some bullshit that a defense attorney would use on someone who killed a black child. Like, right. You can change the value of laws depending on who the person is, or, you know, that a love of a child, of your own child, somehow is more important than not killing other people's children with a chainsaw, and that that worked.
Yeah. No, it's absurd. And then in the story, like Lightspitter, you know, where we're following a school shooter, you're basically in the psyche of a school shooter who starts the process. He's in a bathroom stall, takes out his gun, goes out, walks into a library and murders a girl. And then you're immediately in kind of like this limbo space with him and with the girl. Mm-hmm. She's an angel. He's not sure what he is.
We're not sure if he's dead. He's shot himself, but we don't know.
Do we not know if he's dead? But they're moving together. They're moving together.
Yeah, she is definitely dead and becoming an angel. And my understanding was that we weren't quite sure the EMTs were working on him. So he was like kind of in between. That was how I read it.
Oh, interesting. Wait, does he survive at the end?
We don't know.
Oh, crazy. But so then they go through together, their spirits,
right,
to basically save like a couple different people, right?
Right.
But she is very much like, get the fuck away from me. I don't want to know you. And she's already moved on. Like,
right.
She has this sense of distance from herself and the world and who she is now.
Right. And who she's becoming as an angel.
And through this process, this school shooter kid basically is able to kind of have a clearer picture of what he's done.
And like why he did it.
And why he did it. Exactly. And what we need as people in order to feel like not so alone for someone to have to do something like that.
Right. Well, first of all, did you ascribe an ethnicity to the shooter and the girl?
I mean, I thought it was like a white dude and a black girl.
Okay, me too. But then I was also like, maybe it's supposed to be.
But it could have been switched. It was sort of like up for grabs.
In my mind, it couldn't have been switched.
A black dude and a white girl.
I just don't believe that happens.
Right.
Like, I just couldn't believe, like, it was one of the only stories where I was like, I think this has to be a white person.
Right.
The rest of the characters, I didn't really, like, I didn't think they needed to be or would be, but this one I was like, that's got to be a white guy.
Oh yeah, he was for sure white. I thought maybe she was like Latina or something like that.
Maybe. I just see black people everywhere because I'm black, and I put myself obviously in her situation as a woman. But one of the things that popped up for me in this one, when I started reading the story, before I knew what it was about, I was like, this really reminds me of Isla Vista, which was that shooting of the kid who was like into all the movies and shot up in Santa Barbara area. Yeah,
the one who was basically like,
girls don't like me.
Yeah, exactly. And these brutes.
Yeah. And before it even got to the shooting part, I was like, I feel like this is like a school shooting waiting to happen. Yeah. And then once he started talking about like girls weren't paying attention to him and blah, 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 I was like, that has become this justification and like this toxic masculinity, this entitlement to friends and women. Mm. And this is one of the only stories where I feel like the woman character was really the strong character. I felt like a lot of the other stories were very male heavy.
Yeah,
that the women kind of floated in and out and maybe they had something to say or do, but that this woman in this story was like, she was really the only full woman character for me in the book.
That was like leading it. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I also felt like there was a woman who was kind of saving a young kid like in the era.
Yeah.
And when, you know, this is basically a story that takes place, it feels like in the far future because they're talking about the quick war and the long war. Mm-hmm. Like
In the era.
Yeah. It's essentially like you open up in a classroom.
Right.
And it's a world where everyone is being completely honest to each other.
Right.
So like the teacher says something to the effect of like, you know, back in the day, people used to lie all the time. And I would look at Samantha and I might say she's really beautiful, but we all know she's hideous. And that's like in a classroom of teenagers.
Right.
And the story kind of progresses from there. And then we're following this kid who is a natural born, quote unquote, because there's ways to try to up your situation. But sometimes that might turn out bad. But there's the girl who basically brings her to who brings him to her family.
Right.
And the family is like,
They're
anti all the shit that's going on. They kind of subscribe to the old ways.
Right.
They talk about comedians and jokes and things like that. And so I felt like she was another character who was actually like leading this sort of, you know, corrupted man into a place that might be like better.
Yeah, but I guess for me, for that one, I think I had a hard time because I felt like I was trying to identify who was who, like who are the antis in today's world? Like who are the shoe lookers in today's world? Like who are the people who are normals versus like the enhanced people? Mm-hmm. And I had a hard time because I kept thinking like, I think maybe I'm an anti. Mm-hmm. And so then I felt like...
The antis definitely felt like the heroes to me.
Well, sure, if you are an anti, but if you believe that the correct way that we should be moving toward is away from emotion and towards, you know, pride and intelligence and all those things that were good in that world.
Yeah.
You see, like,
totally.
Like, we are probably antis because we are living in the world that they're talking shit about, right? Like, they're saying in their world, back in our day, we used to lie to people all the time and we were really emotional and we would fight wars for no reason and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, looking at that story, I'm like, oh, I guess I'm an anti. But I wonder if the anti, if you try to find a parallel for it in our world, like, are antis like racist people who believe that, like, in our world, you know, like, what is that line? Are they segregationists? Are they people who are, you know, anti-Jewish, anti-gay, anti, like, so then is she the hero?
I think that the antis would be anti, like, this administration. Because for me, it's like, sure, they are in the book, like, touted as people who are striving for intelligence or whatever, but it feels like people that are actually like, this is what we need for our country now, right? This is how we have to, like, we have to basically take control of what we feel like we don't have control over. That's why they inject like good into them, because they think that they are like putting something into themselves that's going to make their world a better place, where in actuality it's controlling them. And so people who believe more in like, no, we need to be open and we need to be able to have conversations and we need to not try to just like completely, you know, stranglehold like everything that we've had is to me, that was sort of more what I was equating it with. And shoe lookers were people who got caught in the middle of that, you know, people who are the consumers of social media constantly, who basically don't know how their brain functions anymore or what to believe, because the information being fed to them literally only forces them to stare at their shoes.
Interesting. I think we totally interpreted it so differently, which is like, I think that this story is the most ambiguous of all of them.
Yeah.
And I guess if you're looking at it in that moment, it's like the antis might be the heroes. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to draw parallels to this moment, I feel like you could find a way to make the antis the bad guys.
Yeah, 100%. No. And I think that's true with so many of the stories.
Yeah.
Like, even the one with the aborted fetuses.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because I don't think that story was trying to make me pro-life or something like that.
Yeah, I had that same thought.
Because it didn't. It didn't make
well,
me.
Well, right.
Yeah.
You're going to be hard-pressed to make me pro-life just in general.
And so, but what I thought was interesting about it was like the absurdity of thinking that these fetuses had these thoughts and feelings and that kind of situation where it's like, You're scared that like the fetus is gonna wake up on your pillow and there's gonna be twins and they're gonna be fighting over what you've done to them and lead you through this whole path of what's been created. Like, no, that's not the situation.
Wow. Oh my God, you just totally changed my whole thought about that story because I didn't really get it. I have a hard time reading satire. I often feel like I am too literal and like miss the joke. But I was kind of like with this one, like, I don't know, is this like weird, like pro-life? Like, but now that you're saying that, I'm like, sure.
I think that is the version of it, which is sort of what I was saying before. Like, so in Friday Black specifically, like you have this clear shot at consumerism.
Right.
But our lead character is
like
very
so
flawed.
Into it.
He's very into himself. He's very into winning. He wants to beat that other girl, you know? And so I think he's always trying to show the absurdity of what we're dealing with on a couple different levels.
Right.
Because it's like, yes, you know, there's clear ways to interpret what's going on, but then there's also this other thing where it's like, I feel like I could be that person also.
Sure. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Well, I know that the author worked in retail for a lot. Like, he talks about that. He's talked about that. And I feel like he has clearly some feelings about consumerism and working in retail. And I think that one of the big takeaways for me, because there's three stories that really take place in that mall. So it's in retail, Friday Black, and then How to Sell a Jacket as Told by Ice King or something. And they follow the same characters.
And it's the only...
it's the only repeat.
Right.
And he basically is saying two things. One is that we're getting to a place where retail therapy is actually therapy. Like, that you need to buy these things to be cool, to feel cool, to do a good job, to show that you're loved, to show that you love someone. And that, like, there's so much value put in objects, which in turn makes the salesperson your therapist. Like, they're trying to help you to figure out what will make you happy, will make you cool, whatever. And then the other part of it is that everything and everyone in retail is expendable, right? Like, you go on your break,
bye, we forgot about you. Like, I could just buy you a pizza because you're not actually worth a raise. Or like, they went from giving them money to giving them a, giving him a pizza. Like, right. It was like, oh, we actually can't even afford to give you guys anything for winning the challenge because we actually realized we don't need to.
Yeah.
Because you're still going to sell the shit or you'll lose your job, at which point bye, we'll replace you.
Yeah.
And like this idea that there are so many people who work in retail, which is something that we're all so dependent on, who are expendable. And then there's online sales, which is really making retail jobs like obsolete in a way. So he like there's so many layers in all of it, and all the little trademark signs throughout the book on all the things like good and the jackets. And
yeah, it's very plain language that then leads you down these crazy, crazy paths. I mean, there. What did you think about the hospital one?
I had a hard time with that one. I think that was the one that fit in the least for me.
I mean, I felt a little bit like it was kind of shooting at our medical system.
Sure.
And the way that, you know, he obviously has a father relationship, kind of father-son. Right. I don't know if he's lost his father.
His dad, I think, is still around because in the acknowledgments.
He thanks his dad?
Well, the line that he says to his dad, because I like flagged it, because he says to my father who said, if you have an A-plus mind and get a B-plus, even God will be angry.
Right.
So I don't know if his father's still around, but he obviously... There's
holding
a relationship
holding
there.
Him to a very high standard, obviously. Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, I don't even know what to really say about that one.
Because there was like the whole 12-tongue God.
There was the 12-tongue God.
Where he like exchanged his ability to write with something, the tongue of the God. So it was like maybe he was writing for God, like this other person, this other entity.
Yes, it was. Well, there was that. And so because they were there with his dad, right, who was kind of getting some checkups. It felt like his dad was
like
sick,
having some sort of pain.
Yeah, having some kind of pain. But then he would walk into other people's rooms and say, you are healed. And that person would then kind of fly up for a second, like fall down, but then be...
Well, at first he was like walking through. They couldn't find a place to go. They didn't know like where the dad was. He got like because he went to park and the dad.
Yeah.
You know, which honestly is like the most hospital thing ever. Parking at the hospital is a nightmare always.
Yeah.
but so then he's like trying to find his dad. And he keeps walking past the two old guys in radiology and then this family that's like awaiting bad news. And he can't tell if the stress of it is so much that that's why they're so upset or if they've actually gotten the bad news or not. And then like the 12-tongue God comes in and is like, oh, well, you could fix this.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, this was actually the most personal story because and maybe I'm just saying that about the writing, but also the way that the patients react to him of saying being healed to me is sort of what his work does, where it's sort of like we're all like in a hospital and to some degree right now. And then these words like lift us up in a way that is both like, you know, we're in the air and we don't know what's going to happen to us. And then we're dropped down into reality because he has this way that's like, you know, I'm going to take you up and lift you in these beautiful stories and then be dropped into nowhere. Because the last line is the father saying, what have you done?
Right.
They're sitting in the car watching people walk out of the hospital, lift up and then fall to the ground.
Right.
And so to me, that felt like a version of how he saw himself and maybe the relation that he has with his dad to his writing.
You're so good at this. Do you want to host this podcast?
No, I don't know if that's true.
I know, but you have so many interpretations. I was just like, I don't get it. Next one. But I guess my question is, I understand like the metaphor that you're drawing, but my question is like, what actually happened in the story? Like, I didn't understand the relationship between him and the 12-tongue God. I didn't understand like what was he writing before he made the deal and what was the deal that if he took it, he would have to be the decider of who lives and who dies. Like, is that what it was?
Well, I mean, to me, like anytime you're creating art, you're channeling something else, right? it kind of comes from somewhere else. Now, that's not to say that you're not working your ass off to fucking figure out what it is that you want to say.
Sure.
But when you're really in that space, when we're doing anything, it's like, oh, something else has taken over.
Right. I'm in the zone.
In the zone, being in the zone. And so sometimes that can feel like you've made a deal with the devil.
Right.
You know, or this 12-tongued God or whatever it is. And so to me, him putting out this book is this exchange of like, okay, you're putting out some crazy stories into the world. You're going to be fucking with people to a serious degree as they read this. And yet it's going to change things. So your life is going to be changed forever.
Yeah. I'm processing all of this because I just hadn't really thought about it in that way.
I could just be pulling that from fucking nowhere, but.
Right. And then I guess the commentary on the medical industry would just be
some side shit.
This is a mess.
Yeah.
This is a mess. So one of the things in this book that I really liked that I'm sure some people probably are uncomfortable with is all the violence. But for me, it makes a lot of sense because I feel like what he's saying is if we continue on this path that we're on in the current moment in America, it can only lead to more extreme violence as we become more accustomed to it. So like in Finkelstein 5, it's not just that he kills 5 kids. He kills them with a chainsaw.
Yeah.
Like that's like basically hand-to-hand combat, right? I mean, not actually because that equates.
They have a chainsaw.
He has a chainsaw, but it also equates that the children were doing something back to him, which they were not.
Yeah.
As far as I understand, because I guess the littlest girl was running away and she was found far. I mean, that story is so aggressive. And I do want to call out, I think that the 5 is a reference also to the Central Park 5, right? That like, that like specifically the number 5, because it could have been the Finkelstein 4.
Yeah.
And it would have had the same alliteration. But that, yeah, like that this violence is, that it's, we're sowing the seeds of this violence because in the future, it's not going to be enough just to shoot a black kid. You're going to have to chainsaw them to death. Like, it's not going to be enough to trample somebody at a mall. You're actually going to have to become a full-on zombie if you want the jacket, right? Like,
yeah, these are all cautionary tales.
Yeah.
It's basically like, it's both current in terms of what we're living and also a cautionary tale as far as where we're going.
Right.
And so he needed that type of shock to really paint, you know, to be convincing with with what he was talking about, because the truth is if you just pull headlines, we're already desensitized to that. So we're like, oh yeah, okay, a cop kills a kid with unarmed in the middle of the road,
right?
Great, I've heard that one,
right?
You know, whereas like he needed to be like, no, fucking chainsaws and
the girl was 7. Exactly. Also, that fucking part where it's like she was 7. Oh, she looked like 13 or 14. Like, motherfucker, 7 and 14 don't look alike. I don't care how – the girl could have been 6'5 and been 7 and she still would have looked 7.
Yeah.
Like, how dare you? And then there's also this not just experiencing or like not just taking in the violence, but also then in Zimmerland, there's like having to
–
that was probably my second favorite.
Yeah.
Having to invoke the violence or like being a part of it – and turning it into, commodifying it,
And commodifying social justice, you know, because I feel like we are in this place right now where it's cool to have a political platform. And so people are now basically, they are making money off of people doing political shit. And that, you know, just like the movies that we were talking about last week, where it was like people want to make money off of political things, but then it totally gets warped.
Right.
And it totally fucks us up even more, depending on how it goes. So to have this like weird thought that becoming George Zimmerman was going to cure people of their needs is just such a, you know.
And then if that's the commodity, if we're selling being the quote unquote hero and killing Trayvon Martin, then the question becomes at the expense to who? What does that do to the guy who has to dress up like Trayvon Martin every day?
Oh my God. Yeah.
Like, I mean, what does that say to you about the value of that life?
Yeah. I mean, in some senses it reminded me of Top Dog Underdog. You know, of dressing up like Abe Lincoln in whiteface and getting killed every day.
I forgot about that.
At the expense of white people coming to see them.
Right, to enjoy.
Yeah, totally. No, I mean, the psychology of that dude is fucking crazy.
Right. And then that the girlfriend, like, this is another depiction of a woman in this story that's, like, not so great, mm-hmm. right? That she's like, oh, don't do that. Don't, like, she gets it. This is bad for you. Don't do it. And then she gets offered a job to be whatever and date the dude, the main dude. And then all of a sudden, she's, like, not about it anymore.
Yeah. No, that's true. He does, I guess, have... He's 27, you know, he's probably dealing with some shit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's not necessarily like
a shot.
Yeah, it's just to notice like the representation of Black women, because I think that's also like a huge part of the conversation right now when it comes to like Black Lives Matter and Black liberation, is that Black women and trans women and queer women in the Black community are not given the same respect or light. I guess not light shine
as Black men.
As Black men,
yeah, totally.
And even though we all, I mean, we don't, maybe we don't all, but if you don't know, Black Lives Matter was started by three Black women.
Yeah,
it. I mean, they take so little of the credit, really. Like when you think about a movement, and maybe that's because they are women, but it's interesting when we see these depictions now, like the creative interpretations on the current moment, mm-hmm. how are women depicted in this,
yeah, that's
you know?
True.
So it's just an interesting thing to think about. It's not necessarily a shot. It's just kind of like, well, where do they go in the art? And like the same thing happened with Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between mm-hmm. the World and Me. He got a lot of flack for not including Black women in the same way. And obviously he was writing a book to his son as a Black man, but you know, there are Black women in their lives that, so it's just, that's kind of a question that I always think about. Like, yeah. Where are we on that?
That sounds like a good question for him.
I might just ask him.
You should.
I might just ask him. No, by the time y'all hear this, you'll already have heard my interview with Nana. So you'll know what I asked him, but Wade doesn't know yet, cause I haven't done it yet. We record out of order. So the other thing in Zimmerland that I think is so important, and it was the one thing that I was like, this story, it warps it a little bit, because when he puts on his trademarked suit, the like bodysuit, after the first physical interaction, mm-hmm. he turns it on to protect himself, but it makes him bigger and more swole and more intimidating.
Yeah.
And that question for me then becomes, you know, what is that saying? Is that saying that this is what white people want to see so they can justify their actions?
Yes.
And so they give them that? Or are we saying that they are justified in seeing that?
Right. Well, I mean, I think
both.
Yeah, I mean, the third layer is just literally out of necessity so that their like subject doesn't die.
Right,
you know,
but couldn't it just
situations?
Be something that's like protective, that's not like, doesn't make your clothes fit tighter and make you look hella buff?
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
100%.
Like that was definitely a choice.
Yeah. I think it's in the same vein of like, you know, in the pamphlet or whatever, they're taught to respond to what they're given.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's like if he greets you with a smile, you greet him with a smile.
Right.
If he says, you know, if he kind of comes aggressive, then you kind of come aggressive. Because I think that, and that's basically the opposite of playing with what people actually are.
Right. Because
it's like, so, because we mirror what we get from people, mm-hmm. that happens in any kind of altercation, mm-hmm. And so to basically talk about that in this story helps us understand. Well, yeah, like if you're in that situation, like why would we just fucking shrink? You know, like mm-hmm. why can we not be like, excuse me, like is there a problem that's happening
right.
here? Whereas like the suit that you're talking about is actually fucking with people's ideas of what we all look like,
right?
You know, saying that we're also that we all look like this
right.
to everybody,
or that a 7-year-old could look like a 14-year-old,
yeah, exactly,
with the right suit on, and then they open it up to being able to bring kids.
Yeah, that's the big turn, and because they already have the school shooting.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when they
that's
add.
The one they open up.
They have like a train terrorist on a train,
right?
There's three. I can't remember the third one, and then they open it up to have like a school terror attack or something. I think that's
right.
what they call it.
Yeah.
But a school shooting, and you're trying to figure out who's doing it or who's to blame.
Yeah.
Which of course then gets, I'm sure, into a slippery slope. But then you can also now bring your kids to the Trayvon Martin simulation.
Right. Because the last image is a son standing mm-hmm. next to his father.
Right.
And he says, like, go inside. So he's basically like, you know, it's this idea that the youth are watching.
Right.
Always.
And that, like, now the dad is performing something different. Mm. Right. Like, he's performing protection.
Right.
That there's more for him to lose. Now he really can't back down because, mm-hmm. like, you don't want to look like a softie in front of your kid. Like, you're trying to show your kid to stand up for the neighborhood and, like, right. be a good. Yeah. And, like, I mean, also, it's great that he talks about that there's three options. Like, you could call the police.
Yeah.
You could have a gun or you could go hand to hand. Wasn't it hand to hand?
Oh, I guess that's what that was. I mean, it was just blank. The box was just empty.
Right.
So it was a phone, it was a gun, or it was just empty.
Right.
Which you're right. It does just say, it just does mean hand to hand, or it means your words.
Right.
You know, it means, like, you don't get in a physical altercation.
Right. Or maybe
them.
You just shut the fucking window and get out of here and recognize that black people live nearby you.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
truly.
You just say hi and yeah. welcome.
Are you lost? No? Okay, great. Yeah. Gotta go.
Yeah.
My kid's inside.
I mean, are you lost turns into something very
sure,
fast.
But at least are you lost isn't what the fuck are you doing here with here's my gun.
Yeah.
At least are you lost is I'm just on some fucking I don't even know yeah. my own shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't, did we forget anything that we just have to talk about? I'm trying to think. Well, I know a lot of people have said that they couldn't wait to see this turned into a Black Mirror type thing.
For sure.
And I think that, like, it really lends itself to that. But then I also wonder, like, how do you make it? And how do you make it so that it works?
Mm.
How do you make it so that it works and the Black characters get the same kind of respect and compassion that you might give to the white characters,
mm.
right? Like,
you mean when someone is watching
yeah.
it? Right.
Yeah.
Because these characters are flawed and yet they are existing in a even more flawed world.
Well, and you're going to view it in the world that you're in. Because
mm-hmm.
he's really, I mean, I think that, like, Ajay Brenya is really, he's reaching for something bigger and it's not quite necessarily perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wonder about the gaze of others onto his process like
yeah.
that, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, I think that they, you know, they can be used as a jumping off place. There's mm-hmm. also a world in which, you know, just the Finkelstein Five becomes some
thing.
Other thing.
Right. I mean, Zimmerland is its own thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, following an actor that has to play Trayvon Martin over and over again, you know, that's its own kind of dystopian film that you can really then be able to get into what you're talking about the psyche of these Black characters and
right.
not feel like we're glossing over what it is that they're dealing with.
Totally. And there is one thing I wanted to mention in the Finkelstein Five. At the end, when they're like beating up the white people or whatever, and then the cops are called and he's like, I felt myself becoming a 10.0.
Oh, yeah.
And then it ends with, and then, like, they shoot him and he's a zero, he's a nothing point nothing.
Right.
And I was like, that's exactly right. As soon as
they're
Black
dead.
People get, no, as soon as Black people get to that place on the Black scale, it all of a sudden becomes, oh, now we can just cut it out. Like, it's like they were waiting for him to get that far
right.
so that they could say, oh, well, he was violent. He was a 10. We had to cut him down.
Completely. Yeah. And then when we're dead, then there is no, like, to me, that is like, it was never there.
Right.
There was never a scale that had to be there.
Right.
You know, like, you realize only in death, I guess, that this never was a real thing.
Say more.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking in this moment where it's like, when you have that moment of zero point nothing or whatever, mm-hmm. of nothing point nothing, that's when they feel safe.
Mm.
But it's also like, hopefully that's when, well, I'm getting into some other territory, but I feel like that is a moment where you realize, like, oh, what have I done kind of situation.
Sure.
That's what I hope. That
sure.
you see someone in that place and you're like, what have I done? There was never a scale. I never should have been threatened.
Right.
But I guess as I say that, that sounds pretty fucking crazy because it's almost like they need to do that in order to feel safe.
Well, right. And I don't think that the scale was ever for Emmanuel or for the Black people. The scale was always, like, for the white people.
Right.
Right. Like, that they
were bringing the scale down. That's where they wanted it to be.
I think, well, I don't know. In my mind, maybe it was more like for white people, if you're around a 4 or 5, that's fine. And if you're above a 5, we're just biding our time until you get to a 10 and we can kill you kind of thing.
Right.
Like that it's like, oh, we're in that like danger zone and you have to like, maybe you have to clear an 8. And at that point, you're done. Your body's no longer your own. Like yeah. we take control of it. I mean, he doesn't say that, but like that's the kind of thing that I feel if you turn this into a full length something that you could really explore.
Yeah.
And like, is the scale outside of you? Like, can you see it?
Right.
Can other people see it? Or can you, do you only know what you're at? Because mm-hmm. sometimes, like, I mean, this happens to me all the time. People are like, oh, you're so angry, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm actually not angry right now. Like, my scale, I'm just telling you my story. I have high energy.
Right.
But, like, you interpret that as, you know, like someone else.
Yeah, that's, like, what Amanda says. Amanda Seals, I'm not hostile. I'm passionate.
Mm, exactly.
But I think that the scale is definitely something that, you know, because I feel like you know how black you are in the world.
Right. Yeah. You can fuck with your own scale.
Yeah.
But I guess the question is, can you see your own number or can you just kind of know that you're putting it up and putting it down?
To know exactly where you're at,
saying? I don't know. It's just something, like, I'm just kind of like taking this whole idea a little bit further, like a little outside of the story mm-hmm. and thinking like, can you ever know? Because like, I might be a 6 to Michelle, but Kim might think I'm an 8.
Right.
Because like for whatever, wherever Kim's coming from.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think the scale is for white people.
Sure.
And I guess it would be, you know, belittling white people to say that all white people interpret the scale in the same way.
Right.
But that's essentially, I think, what he's doing.
Me too. I mean, that's what I think too. But then, I mean, in the story, he does like, Emmanuel says, oh, I could feel my blackness getting to a da-da-da, to a da-da-da.
Right.
So I wonder if it makes it an interesting story if he doesn't necessarily know his own numbers, but he can just feel that when he's manipulating it versus actually being able to monitor it closely. So like you think you're calm because everybody's probably had that experience, white, black, you know, Korean, whatever, where they feel like they're doing one thing, but their feedback they're getting from others is like, oh, you're really emotional today. And you're like, I'm not emotional. Or like, why are you being so defensive? So right. you try to peel it back, but it actually pushes you more to defense, you know, like, totally. So I wonder if that's like a different play on this story that it's like, you can control it or you can try to control it, but you can never know what the other person is seeing on your scale.
Yeah. No, that's interesting.
I will write a follow-up called The Finkelstein 5 Revisited. Poorly written, but interesting in theory.
I mean, I would read it. Maybe just the blackness scale.
Yeah. I mean, like, the blackness scale is genius.
Yeah.
It's actually a genius concept.
For sure.
Well, okay, I think we're done here.
We did it.
We already did title and cover and everything, but Wade, thank you so much for coming and being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Tracy. This was fantastic.
All right. We'll talk to everyone later. See you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening. That does it for us today. Thank you to our guest, Wade Elaine Marcus, for joining us. And thank you to the people over at Mariner Books for sending us a copy of Friday Black. Remember to listen to Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya on The Short Stacks, which is up now. For more on The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. Check out our website at thestackspodcast.com. To join the Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, like perks and the book club and more, go to patreon.com/thestacks. For one-time contributions, go to paypal.me/thestackspod. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you got your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please rate and review this show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. I will see you in the stacks.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.